It's an honor to introduce Ray O'Kay.
My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. I guess everybody I see is here, huh? Wasn't always that way. I'm a member of the Miami Men's Group, trilingual, multicultural, misanthropic women haters in Miami, Florida. And the harbor unit, John Olson, the harbor unit. In the summer, I live in Carolina Beach, North Carolina. And as they say in the South, because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works, and because of the grace of God, people like you, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink since November the 24th, 1965. And this guy said to me, "You're lying bastard, you were drunk last Tuesday." I said, "I know, but it wasn't necessary." Bill asked me to come talk here because I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been someplace for a long time. And I grew up, or at least I got a little taller in the beginning, in one of the neighborhoods in the Bronx. And my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you may not understand Willis Avenue out here in San Diego, but let me tell you, they drank in that neighborhood. You would see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. I'm from a dysfunctional family. I just found out about 3 years ago I'm from a dysfunctional family. I thought it was all right. I didn't have a father. My mother was alcoholic. And we all drank a lot. I was going through the Catholic school system, which is a very fine system to go through, but difficult to go through when you're drunk. I got thrown out of high school 6 times, Cardinal Hayes High School, 6 times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. I don't know how it happened that I went to college, but I went to college. It's still a mystery to me how they took me. What was even more mysterious was I went to college in Vermont, which is a third world country north of the Bronx. And they had no bars in that state. There were no bars. And some people lived there. They persisted in living up there, and there were no bars. And you could buy beer in a restaurant and drink it out of a bottle. And so that's what we did. And the college kids sat around, we drank beer out of a bottle, and we sang dopey college songs, and we wore white shoes in the wintertime. And I was very collegiate, trying to fit in, you know how alcoholics are, I was trying to just slip in there. World War II was just about over, and we were winning. It looked like a good deal. So I got a haircut one day, and I joined the Navy. And 50 years ago today, I was right out there on a boat on its way to the South Pacific. When I left here and went from here to Pearl Harbor and then into the Marianas. And very nostalgic, you know. We were out there somewhere. Who the hell knows where, but I was out there somewhere. My naval career was extremely valorous. I spent 3 years of my life undecorated, unhonored, unpromoted, and got to see very little of anything except a lot of saloons. And I have great interest in history and historic shrines, and I didn't see any of those things. I don't remember what I saw in San Diego except Tijuana, where I received a very severe infection. which persists to this minute on rainy days. But I'll be fine. I'll be all right. They just took out one of my livers. I'll be okay. I'm just waiting to go on the OJ defense team. I'll be all right. It's a little attempted humor there. So I was staggering around the college campus. I got back from the Navy, back to school, and the government was giving me money to go to college. It was a marvelous thing. And my Irish family didn't understand. Somebody was paying me to go to school. So I was getting a check from the government. I was moderately drunk most of the time. And I was staggering around one day, and there was my name on a bulletin board of people who qualified to graduate. I was right on the list. That was really good news. I thought it had another year to go. So I called up my mother, and she came north. That was a very tender occasion. The widow O'Keefe and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. A few years later, when I was rich, I was a trustee of that college, and I would go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not very often in the state of Vermont they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning and start a fist fight with some guy, you know. You're a tough cookie, my mother. My mother was America's oldest living alcoholic. She died in 1992 at the age of 96. With an old-fashioned in her hand. She went right out of a chair. Went out like a champ. We tried to cremate her. That fire wouldn't go out for 3 days. So I finished college, and who knows how or why, and I came home, and my uncles all ran a job. And in the Irish family, I didn't have a father, so the uncles voted. And they all voted that I go on a job. Because my father was on a job, my brother was on a job, and all my uncles and all my cousins were on the job, by the way, for you tourists, is the New York City Police Department. And everybody in my family was in the New York City Police Department except for my two moron cousins who work for the phone company. Because they couldn't get a job with Con Ed. That's just how the Irish do it. So I told them I'd received a scholarship to Fordham Law School and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And they knew I was going over to the enemy. So that's what happened. I went off to law school. I'd never seen a lawyer before I went to law school. There were no lawyers in my neighborhood. We didn't need lawyers. We had cops and we had priests. What the hell do we need with lawyers? The Monsignor took care of all of our problems. We didn't have to worry about that. If he didn't take care of it, the cops from the 41st Precinct would do it. So anyhow, now I go to law school and I find I'm in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. Christ, they were deadly. They all had on a blue suit and they wore eyeglasses. So you know what I did. I got into uniform. I found a pair of glasses in a drugstore that I didn't need. I stuck them on. And I looked around for someone to drink with, a companion. My mother always told me to play with nice boys my own age, from good Catholic families. And nobody drank in this crowd. They're all studying. They're all just... So I went on a wagon for law school. I stopped drinking. And I went on a wagon. I could do it then. And as a result of all that, I did very well in law school. I was a big star. And as a result of that, I was taken into a large Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. My superiors decided I should be a trial lawyer, so I was sent up to the courthouse on sent to Street to learn my trade, and I wasn't there very long when I discovered that all the brilliant guys were across the street in the bar. So I moved my office into the bar, and I got a little priority, a little credit, and I learned to drink in a different way, a more civilized way, more genteel way. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. They gave you scotch in a tall glass with water and ice. You sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the rituals and all of the mysteries that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this afternoon and to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal, and they knocked me senseless. It was necessary in my natural development that I be married, and I had located a lady, or she had located me. Who knows how these things happen? Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife, I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Ms. O'Keefe is a very lovely person from a totally different background than mine. She was raised in a nice family with a big house and a fence and a dog. In a word, her family had a buck. I drank a lot in those days, but I knew what was happening. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. There was only one fight. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter, and otherwise it was a very lovely. We set up housekeeping, and Miss O'Keefe began to produce children with the regularity that is known only to the Roman Catholic. And after about two kids came along, I received a phone call to go down and see the dean of the Fordham Law School, so I did, and he put me on a faculty. And I became Professor O'Keefe. I responded to that appointment by being very, very nervous. God, I was nervous. And I didn't know what the hell, you know. Very few guys from my neighborhood became law professors. Very few. And I couldn't find the others to ask them how they did it, so I went on the wagon again. But I couldn't do it. I tried to go on the wagon because I was afraid of the job, but I couldn't do it. So I decided that I would drink less. I ended up drinking more when I was drinking less than when I was drinking less, because when I was drinking less instead of more, made me so goddamn nervous that I had to drink more in order to drink less, if you understand what I'm talking about. I was drinking moderately. I was putting about two quarts away, trying to, you know, I'm tapering off. But what happened was a few years went by, and I found out that I'm a competent teacher. I didn't know that, but I found that out by doing it. It was okay for me. I know how to do that stuff. I'm talented in that one area. I can do that. So once I found that out, it took about two or three years. There's no need to control my drinking. So I went out and I drank the way I like to drink. I really only knew one way how to drink. My brother Billy, if you put us together, he would not take us for brothers. He was about 6'2", 6'3", very good looking and handsome and athletic and all that stuff. And I didn't have a father, but I had Billy, and I did everything like Billy. I tried to. I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops arrived. You know, that's the way Billy did it. So I started drinking that way again. And by this time, Ms. O'Keefe and I had it up to, 6 or 7 or 8 kids in that area, you know. A lot of kids. They were all around. They lived in the same house with us and everything, you know. They were all over. You'd see them walking around. And six of them are in AA right now. Including Mrs. O'Keefe. Seven, including Mrs. O'Keefe. So I had it up to about 2.5, 3 quarts a day now. And Mrs. O'Keefe began to act a little weird. She was not entirely silent. I hate that in a woman. And she said there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. You see, she's not an attorney. She does not have the benefit of a legal education. So I have to explain things to her. So I was explaining things to her. I was explaining to her the relativity of alcoholism, which is to say that some people drink more than other people. All right, so far? Tell you look at me for, I'm telling you. I said, based on a relative scale, I am not such a big drinker. As a matter of fact, I said, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she said, nobody drinks as much. So I had to leave and go and see Mom. And we did a number, Mom and I. So this drove her crazy, Mrs. O'Keefe. So she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. I am one of the few men in Alcoholics Anonymous who come here upon the advice of a gynecologist. He couldn't find anything wrong with her until she mentioned me. And then he knew. So he sent her home to me with a message. The message was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the law professor, as an alcoholic. Oh, I was so upset to get this news. I rose to defend myself, as is my custom. And I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without ever having seen the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice, all too common in our country today. And then I went into high gear and I asked Ms. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. Right? You got it. And at this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a terrible rate. And then it happened. I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain how this happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I'm giving here. But in the middle of all of this yelling and confusion, I stopped, and a great silence, and I admitted to Ms. O'Keefe, for the first time I'd ever admitted to anyone, that there was a possibility I don't want to go too fast here. There was a possibility that on many public occasions I had permitted myself to be overserved. Of course, a lot of money go to law school. This was a very serious tactical error. 3 days later, I was a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side. There's a little hole in the door, and a guy was looking. And in addition to everything else horrible that was going on, it also happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was hanging around. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day I had attained age 35, and therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. So he administered to me some vile narcotic, and I never saw him again. He left me. He abandoned me. And in those days, you know, there were no treatment centers. There were no 28-day horseshit, whatever it is. And the hospitals didn't take alcoholics. And you were in regular nut houses, and that's where I was. And I went into some kind of a coma, but I came out of it, and I demanded to see the head of the hospital. Of course, who the hell else would I talk to? He fixed his cool professional glance upon me. You know that smarmy voice they use? And he said, tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much? So I told him of my wealthy parents. I told him Momsie and Dada used to travel a great deal, and I was left in the hands of cruel servants who were black. And I become insecure and turned toward alcohol. He was very sympathetic. Said he had seen this before. Said I wasn't concerned myself, it would be all taken care of. And I said, thank you, ever so. And off he went. And about 10 minutes later, another one came in and asked me the same question. So I told him of my impoverished youth. I told him about the beatings I got in the hands of my drunken mother. I even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck and I chased her around the house for 2 days with a knife. He said I'd come to the right place. He said help was at hand, and one day I would drink safely again. And I said, thank you, doctor. He was my kind of a doctor, this doctor. So I went back. I was playing Monopoly with a couple of guys, or three guys, and myself. We had a Monopoly game going, and they weren't alcoholics, they were just there. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly, and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you do pretty good, you know? So I had the boardwalk, I had some hotels, and I was not thinking about drinking. The Monopoly therapy was working. And I was about to reconquer the world. And they told me I had a visitor. I went, who the hell visit? I never had any visitors. So I went to my large executive type pad itself. I waited, and the visitor came in. Very imposing looking guy. Shirt, suit, tie. Very, very imposing. And he said he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the hospital had given up on me. and asked him to come by and talk to me about this program. Alcoholics Anonymous program. You won't believe what this man said to me. You know what he said to me? Listen to this. This is the kind of person they send out. He said, shut up. I immediately forgave him because I intuitively knew that someone had forgotten to tell him who I was. So I thought it would be helpful to him if I told him who I was. A very rude person. He said to me, shut up and sit down. Bastard. I was not a well person, so I sat down. And he began to tell me this story of his. Fascinating. And he said, would you like to go with me to meetings? Meetings? What kind of meetings? He said, meetings of alcoholics. Meetings of alcoholics, yeah. Where are these meetings? He said, outside. I said, I'll go with you. Besides that, he gave me matches. Let me have a book of matches. And I was way ahead. And that was in 1963. And off we went, and he made arrangements for me to go locally when I came home. And I came home and started going. I don't remember so much of all of that. I was too new and too afraid and too everything. And in those days, the medical community was under the impression that the disease of alcoholism was caused by some type of a Valium deficiency. So they wanted to make sure your Valium level never fell down too low because your alcoholism would break out. So when I got out of the hospital, I had about a gallon jar full of these things. And I used to keep them loose in my pocket, and my instructions were, we feel like a drink, eat one of those. Well, I felt like a drink all the time. So I'm walking around going to AA meetings, not drinking, and my head is buzzing, and I'm walking into walls, you know. My wife said, how come it take you so long to get home? I said, I got lost, you know. I was a little confused. And so in order to settle the problem, I got drunk instead. And I got drunk again. And I lasted 10 months, and then I got drunk. In October of 63, I got drunk. And then I found out about alcoholism. I turned away from the great power that is in this program. I turned away from the great force of this program. And only this program, which supports and sustains alcoholics. And I walked away from it. And things began to happen to me that had never happened to me before. And I'm not talking about things that happened to me which I don't even consider, well, I thought they were very important at the time. I don't think so now. I'm not talking to you about the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty of the Fordham University School of Law as a tenured professor of law, almost unheard of. It is unheard of. And that all of the honors and all of the appointments and all of the commissions and all of the dollars that went with that were taken from me about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you the fact that I was in serious, I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulty. I do not even speak to you the fact that I had lost the affection of everyone who was around me. And for the last several months, I guess, of my drinking, I was living in a car. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew what happened to people who drank the way I did. I knew about my family. I've been to the funerals. We used to make a joke out of it. Doesn't he look good? We said, why not? He stopped drinking. Yeah. And I guess if I thought about it at all, I guess I thought, now it's my turn. It's everybody else's turn. Now it's my turn. I guess. I don't know. I can't remember. It's so long ago. But I tell you this, I did not think it was possible for me to stop drinking. I didn't think so. I did not think that was possible. But my time came. One day, my time came. I don't know any more about this than you do. But it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are not permitted to go. And it seems to me that there is a point somewhere below which we are not permitted to sink. And it also seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where this line is for you. How would I know? I only know what happened to me. And this is an individual and personal thing. And I think it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. They call one night from the vets in Minneapolis to say that my brother was dead of alcoholism. He was 48 years old. And he died the way alcoholics sometimes do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood in the Bronx. But I'll tell you this. My brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. Now, for other people, it can be something trivial. But that line is there, somewhere. And we come to it, you and I, in our own time, in our own way, but come to it we must. Because without an alcoholic bottom, the rest won't happen. Our book tells us we have to be at a point of an alcoholic bottom. You and I must concede to our innermost self that we are powerless over alcohol. That is a spiritual thing, see? Our innermost self. What you're seeing here, this magnificent structure that I present to you, Carol, is my outermost self. The concession of powerlessness has to be made where we live, you and I. We don't live out here. We live here. And I had to do that. And on the 24th day of November 1965, I had 2 or 3 days without a drink. I was vertical. I was even solvent. I had some fresh money. I was in a building in Manhattan. A couple of people let me use, and there was a barn. So I had a decision to make, and I called this lawyer that I knew had been sober for years. And I told him what was going on with me, and he came right over. And he looked so good, and I felt so bad. I said, what do I have to do to be as successful as you in this thing? You know that look they give you, those sponsors? He said, don't drink and go to meetings. You'll be fine. I said, you see, John, you really don't understand the problem. I don't know what the hell I... So I'm wasting my time calling you up. You come over here, you don't know the first goddamn thing's going on. See, the real problem here is this place where I work. I shouldn't be here. I'm too good a lawyer for this place. Yeah, well, except if you don't drink and you go to the meetings, you could get a better place. See, at home it's worse. I'm not even allowed to go up anymore. Well, he said, if you don't drink and go to the meetings, you work that right out. I said, well, you know, I'm being sued by a bank. A misunderstanding. A loan application. He said, yeah, I read about that. Well, he said, if you don't drink and you go to a meeting, you probably sell it. I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so he said, come on, you're not doing anything. He made a couple of phone calls. Put me on a train up. I live in a place called Lashmont. He put me on a train. It's about 40 minutes up there. Halfway up, I reconsidered, you know. Felt like calling. I must have panicked to call that asshole. Don't drink, right? Yeah, sure. Well, his train stops. I show you, don't drink. So that's my attitude. Get off the train in Lashmont. The guy standing on the platform was the fellow that delivered my mail. His name was Al. It's my mailman. And he was then chairman of the local group. And Al said, get in a car. I said, Al, I don't hang out with mailmen. No offense, but I don't hang out with mailmen. He said, some guy called me about you from New York. Will you please get in a car? I can't have a fight with a mailman or anybody else for that matter. So I got Al's car. I said, well, Al, I'm a lot of trouble. Yeah, he said, well, don't drink. You go to me. And that night I was taken to the Mernick group. And I haven't had a drink since. First, I had two members of this fellowship, no other fellowship, this fellowship, two of them. Was so grateful for what God had done. They took what came that day, drunken, dishonest, arrogant. They gave me a day. It's like a little present. They gave me a day. Didn't ask me for anything. Just did it the way you and I do it now. And they gave it to me. And I'm convinced that all of the days that have followed, all 30 years of it, depended on those two men. That day. I hope it is with the same gratitude that they showed that I'm able to talk to you this afternoon. Like Al, like John, I owe everything I have and am, I owe to this program. Everything, I was born with nothing, I came here with nothing. Now it seems I have just about everything there is. That sponsor of mine was surely sent to me by God. He was something. I said to him, how many of these do I have to go to a week? Oh, he said, yeah, we talked about that. He said, based on your education and your obvious intelligence, he said, we think 7 meetings a week ought to... I said, that's every day. He said, you're getting it. He said, I'll tell you what, you can stay home on the days you didn't drink. He said, if you didn't drink on Thursday, you don't have to go on Thursday. Oh, I said, well, I drink every day. He said, I I said, I don't feel good. He said, well, this may be as good as you'll ever feel. Oh, boy. I said, well, I'm very nervous. What do you think I should do? He said, hang on. I said, well, how do you hang on? He said, let go. I said, when am I going to get a good job? He said, when you're ready. Well, how will I know when I'm ready? He said, you'll have a good job. I was like dealing with a Zen master, you know? So now I'm pooping along. I got like 6 months. You know, when you have 6 months, you know a lot. You know? I'm really hot now, and I got about 6 months, and I'm ready to go. I know where to park the car. I know where the bathroom is. I personally know the guy that's making the coffee. And new people are coming in. I'm saying, sit right over there. Don't drink and go to the meetings. Pain in the ass. Don't tell me about your wife and your job. Oh, I'm doing great. So I went to him one time. I'm concerned, you know. Whoop. Jesus, my group. They're back. See, this will get everybody drunk. You know? The steps are supposed to be there. Traditions are supposed to be there. I remember the time they went from the Sweet and Low in the packages to the Bulk. 20 guys got drunk the next week. They just can't change anything around here. So I went to him. He goes, I don't know what's going on. I say, listen, I'm really concerned about the second step. What is a power greater than my own? A little vague, don't you think? I'm an attorney. Let's see. He said, a power greater than your own is a power greater than your own. I felt like I was dealing with Moses. You remember Moses? You remember Moses. My mother went to high school with him over there. Moses one day was talking to a burning bush. Remember that? He was talking to this thing. It was on fire. And naturally, Moses said to this bush that was on fire, who are you? Most of us don't have the opportunity to talk to a bush. And the bush said to Moses, I am that I am. And Moses said, thank you for clearing that up. I said, this power greater than my own. See, I'm an educated person. It appears that there is a capital P there. He said, so it would appear for me too. I said, well, is it God? He said, listen, dummy. A term of affectionate reference. He said, if they wanted to write God, we would have written God. That's a point. He's got a point. He said, you don't need a religious education. You've already had one. He was right. I'm a graduate of a Jesuit university. I had 19 years. What the hell do I need with a religious education? I needed power. Right? The book says, my dilemma is lack of power. If I had written, it would say, my dilemma is I drink too much. Not true. Alcoholism has very little to do with alcohol. Alcoholism is that loneliness, that despair, that remorse, that shame, that feeling of not being good enough, not being a part of. That's alcoholism. I spent a lifetime on the outside looking in, and it pissed me off. And I drank at it. I drank it. Because I didn't belong. I had that feeling since my earliest years. I was in the wrong family. I knew I didn't belong with that bunch. Brother, it was hard to get along with that crowd. I didn't like the schools. I didn't get the right stuff for Christmas. I didn't have a father. There were a lot of things I didn't like. It was all a big goddamn hassle. And then when I was about 12 or 13, I don't know, one of the guys in the neighborhood gave me a can of Schaefer. And I drank it. And my mother was okay. That school was all right. I asked him if he had another kid. I drank it then. Yeah, my sister Marie was a nice girl. And for the first time in 13 years, I felt good. You know? I felt good. It wasn't a hassle. It was okay. That's all. And for the next 25 years, as Silkworth says, I try to recapture that elusive feeling that comes after a few drinks. Drinks which I saw other people having with no effect whatever. Unfortunately, I'm dealing with the substances. And what had happened, and I didn't know it, we don't know it, you and I, we don't know these things. How do you know these things? You know them by going to meetings. Last year, the Grapevine published a letter written in 1961 by Carl Jung to Bill Wilson in response to a letter that Bill Wilson had written to Carl Jung, making reference to Roland Hazard's treatment by Jung in 1933. And Jung replied by saying, I remember Roland, and it wasn't his case, alcoholism. You remember Roland was the fellow that Jung told you're going to die, and he brought the message to Ebby, who brought the message to Bill. He said in Roland's case, he had separated himself from the whole, W-H-O-L-E, expressed in medieval terms, said Jung, he had separated himself from a union with God. And so had I. And then the lack of power in my case was simply that I had separated myself from the power of God. I'm not a religious person. I'm not a church attender. I don't count myself that way. I have nothing against any of those things, but I just don't go. But I'm going to tell you what I think is true, at least it's true with me. Here's what's true. I'm an alcoholic and I can't manage my own life. That's true. And I've shown that to myself to be true. No human power can relieve my alcoholism. Every human power there ever was tried to do it. I couldn't stop for a lovely wife and 7 children. I couldn't stop for a career job. I couldn't stop for bosses, for judges, for United States senators, for presidential candidates, all of whom I work with. I couldn't stop for any of them, love or money. But sitting around a table one night in Mamaroneck with 6 guys and 1 woman, and I stopped drinking. Now what is that? Do you know? It's a power. You come into this room tomorrow, or Tuesday, this very room. You know what's going to be going on here? Nothing. You know what's going on here now, don't you? You feel it? It's a powerhouse. And that power didn't come in here with me. No human power can do for us. But God could and would if he was sought. And God does not make hard terms for those who seek him. He doesn't make hard terms. Are these hard terms? Is this weekend a hard term? Is that incredible experience that I went through last night in that stadium with you, a hard term? Whew. I was shaking when I walked out of there. What a demonstration of the power of God. Nothing less. And it says, as we draw near to him, he will reveal himself to us. And isn't that true? Isn't that the way you and I are with each other? If you want to know about me, get in the car. Join my group. Draw near to me. You'll find out. I'll reveal myself to you. This is the way it is with us. It says, see to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And I count this as a great event that has come to pass for me. I am privileged to speak all over the country, all over the world, as a matter of fact. And here's how I end, because I'm going to end. There's a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous that has been very dear to me. It's called The Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous, written by a Southern Californian now dead. And in the very last page of that pamphlet, the author takes a biblical reference. And he recalls a time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin, Jesus, as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And these two men found the Lord and they walked with him. And they stopped him one day and they said to him, are you the Messiah? Are you the one we've been waiting for all these years? Or should we wait for somebody else? He never answered that question. But he said to these two men, go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk. Said, tell John that the deaf can hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them. In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear sisters and brothers, in happy international convention assembled, if you will accept a report from me, based on 30 years in this program, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based on that personal observation, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear, and most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again, through the longest day and into the darkest night, the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who suffers, the poor in spirit. God bless you.